Okay, let's keep on applauding. Because here is Mr. Joe Brelton, the director of the movie, who today got nominated for 6 Emmy Awards. For which films, then?
We're actually only 5.
Okay, sorry.
3 for our film, Under African Skies, which is terrific, and then 2 for Paradise Lost 3, the final film of the series about the West Memphis 3 case. Okay. So it was quite a day.
And, of course, Paul Simon, my favorite singer-songwriter of all time, and the man who brought us African music. Thank you. Let's start with you, Joe. Do you remember when you first heard the album Graceland?
I do, actually. One of the amazing things about making this movie is, I remember, I'm 50, and I remember 25 years ago when this record came out that I was immediately struck by it. I found it incredibly mysterious and uplifting, and it immediately became one of my all-time favorite records. But I was also very politically aware. I was a supporter of the anti-apartheid movement, and I was
15.
25. I wish I was 15. I never understood the criticism directed toward the recording of this record, even though I was very politically aware. I was confused by it, because I thought what Paul was doing was exporting the very culture that the apartheid movement was trying to, or the apartheid regime was trying to crush.
Were you the only one in your group of friends that had a different opinion, or was this the...
Some agreed with me, some disagreed with me, but I remember having those two very distinct experiences of loving the record, not understanding the criticism. So 25 years later, to have the opportunity to explore both the music, which to me is the more important part of the movie, how this incredible music was made, but also to explore the political story, was just a great opportunity.
Yeah, back to that. Paul is looking back and looking at this movie, discovering this African music, the best thing that could ever happen to you? I mean, this, when it came...
The best thing that happened to me was that I was born.
The best thing that happened to us, yes.
Yeah. Well, it was certainly the greatest part of my musical education.
Reborn.
It was the beginning of really learning about rhythm, and of course the experience of going to Africa and meeting other musicians and fulfilling this concept that I had been thinking about for quite a long time, actually, that the cultures, the world cultures, were really not that disparate.
And then you went to Africa. I can imagine coming from New York, arriving in South Africa for the first time. Did the apartheid, to see it day to day there, didn't that freak you out? I mean,
yes.
Because I remember the first time.
It was very, very tense. And I was coming from a country that was, a racially tense country, and this was taken to a degree that I really had never experienced before.
No, and then you went in the studio, we just saw all of that, and it started to work. Did you already have the feeling that you were changing, history was going to change, or was there a feeling of this?
No, I wasn't that prescient that I would know that, but... this was an idea that I first incorporated when I sang El Condor Pasa with Simon and Garfunkel. When I thought that it was such a beautiful song, there was no reason why any distinction should be made between that song, which was Peruvian, and a pop. Popular American song or pop world song.
So for you, it was very logical.
It was completely logical, and the same is true for Mother and Child Reunion, which where I went to Jamaica to record. And from that idea, extrapolating from that idea and thinking that I would do a whole album of music in the place where the music was born and lived was an idea that it was logical, but still had to be experienced to know whether it was actually going to work.
So you arrived in South Africa. How did it take for the tension to melt for you and the musicians to just?
The tension wasn't between the musicians.
No, I know, but I can imagine that everyone was trying to get used to each other.
Well, you know, it wasn't as hard as you might imagine. What happens is you begin to record, and if it sounds good, and you come back into the control room, sounds good, and you play it back, and sounds like it's going to be good, everybody relaxes and believes in it. I don't think anybody knew that I was going to write, how I was going to write songs over these forms, or how I was creating the forms then, and nobody asked me about it, and I didn't have to explain it.
They actually didn't know what the hell you were doing.
In a certain sense, either did I, you know? But I did know that it was entirely possible to make a track that I was in love with, and that I could write a song over it, and if I didn't like that song, I could erase the song and still have the track that I loved and begin again.
Is there anybody before you who did that this way?
I think so.
Can you have the next song?
I think so. I think maybe not on different cultural levels, but the Rolling Stones made tracks and then wrote the songs. Even Cecilia was a song that was written off of a drum track. So it wasn't the first time by any means that I was going to write a song after the track was made, but it was the first time that I was going to do an entire album in that way, and an entire album that was from a very distant culture to American culture.
Yeah. Who came up with the idea for this film? You or?
We don't know where it came from.
Well, you know, Sony, the record label, wanted to do a 25th anniversary film. Paul and I had worked together on a TV show a few years before.
So I lost part of it?
Yeah, sure.
Sorry, it's no wine. Poof, it's wine.
There was an idea to make a film, but because it was being generated by a record label, I was a little concerned that, you know, we couldn't have the freedom and the depth to go where I wanted to take the film. And so Paul and I, you know, a film is a big investment of time, and you want to make sure you're kind of on the same page.
Did you get conditions on what you could do or couldn't do? Did Paul give you conditions?
No, Paul, you know, for an artist of his level at this stage of his career to open the door to that kind of controversy, I think is incredibly courageous, and I was looking for that kind of honesty. And so we sat and we talked for a couple hours about what kind of film this would be, and if he had said, no, I don't want to talk about that part of my life and let's just focus on the music, I'm not sure I would have done the film. But because he was open to me exploring those areas, and we just had kind of the same vision for the film.
Why did you want to do this? I mean, why would you want to open old wounds? What was your ambition with the film?
Well, it wasn't that I looked at it as opening old wounds, because the truth of the matter is it's really an old triumph. I mean, this album's been a hit for 25 years, and I think for most people, particularly young people, they really weren't even aware that there was a controversy. And to the degree that there was a controversy, it was settled within a year or two when we were all invited by Nelson Mandela, who celebrated his 94th birthday yesterday.
Yeah.
we were invited back to South Africa. So there was really not.
But in the film, we do go big.
Yeah, it was for a time big. Why did I want to go back? Because I thought it was very interesting to go and look at it. And at the time, I remember that Hugh and I and Miriam and Ray and Joseph, most of our press conferences, we were defending ourselves as opposed to explaining what it was that we were actually accomplishing. Most of what came at us was, tell me why you think you didn't do something wrong, as opposed to why was this an enlightened choice, you know? And this film really gives me the first time, and for all of us, a chance to say what we were really feeling.
Yeah, you think now that it was an enlightened choice? I agree.
Yes, I do. I do, because I gave a lot of thought at the time, and I had many discussions with Hugh Masekela in particular, who really mentored me through this whole process, but also with Joseph Shabalala and with Ray and with many of the musicians who were not only extraordinary musicians but also very sophisticated political thinkers. So I had, a lot of time to think about what it was that we were actually accomplishing. And I understood that we were a symbol of what apartheid was opposed to, which was that all peoples belong together and, work together and create together.
That's what surprised me in the movie. You didn't play Sun City. You played with black musicians. You took them all over the world. You made them famous. And still, you got all the shit. And you seem so relaxed. So you must have been really fucking angry when you got home. So listen, look what all I did. And where you must have been real angry. Were you?
Were we real angry here? We were. Were we?
You were cool, none of
you. You know what? What's interesting about this, as the more I look at what happened from the perspective of 25 years, is I really understand everybody's position. And I don't have any blame for anybody, not Dolly Tombo and his position, or anyone.
Were you nervous to meet Dolly Tombo? Because that's a key scene in your movie. And I can imagine the first time you met him, where you're like, this is him, this is it.
No, I wasn't nervous to meet Dolly Tombo. It's one of the benefits of being older than
you were there. Was he nervous?
Well, one of the happy coincidences of the film, he didn't have time to be nervous, is what I'm trying to say. One of the happy coincidences of this film is that was not a planned sequence. You know, I was trying to get an interview with Dolly Tombo while we were in South Africa. Actually, Hugh was very helpful in making that happen. It happened on the third to last day. I did that single interview on the third to last day, and I just had the idea as we were filming that interview to see if he would meet with Paul the next day, and it just happened very quickly. And
it's the key.
They didn't have time to think about it, and I think that interview really elevated the film because
it's very because of that it became a very American movie in the sense that it's a very happy ending. Brothers.
To me,
it feels like that. Does it feel like
I think that ending is justified because
it's happy.
Well, here we are playing 25 years later, and we're doing the series of concerts we played last night. And when you think about it, 25 years ago, the South African people were oppressed people, and now it's a free country. So there's a reason for it to be a happy ending, because from the perspective of a democratic country, that is what happened. And Graceland, I think, contributed in its own way towards that, and I think, of course, so did Dolly Tombo and Oliver Tombo and the ANC and all of the people who fought for the rights for the civil rights movement in South Africa.
Yeah. And for me, the ending actually has a much deeper, you know.
I was just teasing.
No, I know, but I think the theme of, you know, South Africa could have been, and people were worried about it descending into a bloody civil war, and it really could have been. And Mandela and that movement, you know, was a very peaceful transition. And I think two men at the end of the movie not changing their points of view but having empathy for the other's opinion is kind of consistent with that whole truth and reconciliation. And I to me, it's a really, you know, it is a happy ending, right?
We're here in Holland, and unfortunately, one of the key words in this movie, apartheid, is a Dutch word. We're not very proud of that. Just going back a little bit to the history of the anti-apartheid, it seemed that Europe was much harsher than America. I mean, we had a Dutch writer, W.F. Hermans, who went to give a speech in South Africa, came back to Holland, and was never talked to again. You know, was Europe harder on you than America? Was Europe harder on you than America? People in Europe?
Yes.
I mean,
I think that the idea of the cultural boycott was not very familiar to most people in America, much more in England and in Europe. And I could understand, as you say it, I think, of course, that the Dutch would feel a particular attachment to this, you know, to this struggle.
We feel guilty.
Yeah, guilt. There's guilt, you know, and the Americans saw it as a variation of the civil rights movement, the American civil rights movement, which was, black people are being oppressed, white people are the oppressors. In South Africa, black people are the good guys, white people are the bad guys, and that's how we can understand what was going on. Whereas the deeper truth is, it was a very complicated society. It was not. There are tribal relationships that are not even gone into in the film that have an effect upon thinking. Political parties within the Black South African communities were very different in what they stood for. Inkatha was very different from the ANC. Azania was very different. It was more complicated than could be explained to an American.
An American large audience, yeah.
And also, one could say, you know, I mean, there were the people of Dutch ancestry, there was the people of English ancestry, both of which were in the wealth and the power. And there was a small but significant Jewish community in South Africa that played a part. And the description of all of this, if it weren't for the fact that we were dealing with a horror of the actual apartheid, when you look at it from every different perspective, it could be several different documentaries. I mean, if Ray Peary had a couple of million dollars, he could make the Ray Peary.
We because of the
documentary, and tell you the story about how he came to see this whole thing and how he came to see Paul Simon walk into the studio and what he thought and where he came from and where...
It's actually an interesting question, because Ray Peary said in the movie, actually, by not letting us do this, we're being victimized twice. There was a question that I had. What did ANC do with the black musicians who joined you when they came back to South Africa? Were they guilty? Were they not being talked to in the ANC? Were they collaborators or what?
They all left.
Did they victimize you twice?
Hey, oh, you're down here. No, what happened? No, what happened? No, here it is.
Okay, thank you. We have one chair. My next you. Is this microphone work? Were you twice victimized? Were you twice a victim? First because you were black, and then because you went with Paul.
And because he was exiled.
And exiled? Sit down.
Well, you know, by the time we did Graceland, I think I was past political parties. For me, the most important thing was that Paul had been moved by South African music that I came from, and he was the kind of person who would be a great vehicle to affect people who had never even heard of South Africa. And if he brought South African music to them, they would be like knocked out, and they were. And I think he reached more than almost 20 million people that he reached who had never heard of South Africa. But what his fascination with South African music made every artist in the world finally say, I cannot do a CD without talking about South Africa. And at that point, I think we transcended politics, because what people got interested in was the excellence of South African music as seen by Paul Simon, who gave it a great platform. And there is no doubt that South Africa is probably the only country in history where the music especially was a major catalyst for freedom, and Graceland was a great catalyst in that whole exercise.
What I was getting to in my questions to the guys is, isn't it that in the end, Graceland was one of the factors beating apartheid? And you just said that, so...
I don't think anger played a part in all of us, because we just felt so good to be like making so many people feel so good. You know, I mean, we toured for 2 years, we played to millions of people, and here we are now back with Graceland, and people who are not born when we first did Graceland are out there singing all the lyrics with Paul Simon, and the record is back. This documentary is winning awards all over the place. What is obvious is that the strength of good art is bigger than anything else.
Great. I'm really curious to find out the films that I'm going to ask Paul. Paul, what is your favorite scene in the movie, in the documentary? I mean, there must be one scene that you say, oh, yeah.
I always wanted to say that. But it's...
My favorite part is where Dali says, yeah, okay. Dali Thomas says, yeah, okay. We're all brothers. I think that's a great part in the movie.
What's your favorite part in the movie?
Everything.
I think my favorite part is where I said to Dali, you know, you seem to think that we're working for you. That the musicians are working, or that we're working for you, and that's the way the construction of the politics is. It's the pyramid is here, and first the politician, and behind that the money, and then the generals, and then the economists, and then everybody, all the way down to the artists, who are treated as if we worked for everybody else in the pyramid, when in fact, the artists are the representatives of the culture. They're the people, we don't work for them.
Joe, what was your dream scene? You must have, when you made the deal to go make this film, you had something in mind.
Well, you know, I have to say, it was only a handful of days, but all of that rehearsal stuff, getting to know these guys, getting to see how big a heart they have, getting to see how brilliant they are as musicians, that all that rehearsal stuff that we did in South Africa last year just was really special. I mean, these guys really are very inspiring, and so I can't pick one scene, but those moments where we're learning about each one of these fellows and what inspired them and what they're about, to me was cool.
And they've got an Emmy Award or three Emmy Awards.
Oh, you know what other scene I love? I love when Bigidi said, when they say, it's Paul Simon, and they say, I don't know him. They say, no, Simon and Garfunkel. And he says, doesn't ring a bell. Woo!
We have a lot of people on stage and we have a lot of people here. It's time for some questions from the hall. We don't have a microphone there, but if you have a question, stand up. Okay. Tell me your question. I'll repeat it for the rest of the people.
What did you reveal or what did you enclose as a musician? I'm interested in you as musicians. What changed in you, or what happened? Can you describe
during the movie or
no? During the making of the
album.
The album.
The question is, how did your life get changed by getting involved in Graceland? That's what he wants to know.
Well, for me, the The big thing was that I learned to listen on a more intense and deeper level than I had been listening, because the intricacy of the parts and the way symmetry was treated was different from the American version of popular music. So I came into the process with certain assumptions. There was a recognition of a familiarity that I recall from my childhood, but the actual complexity was not apparent to me at first, and I had to listen very, very carefully to hear who was playing what part and what was the essential part that I needed to know when I wanted to write a melody. Was it the intertwining of the guitars? Was it the bass that was giving me the pulse that I needed? And also, what was the overall tone of the combination of the instruments? Because that's what began to give me the stories that I told. Because I struggled with the fact that I was not telling the story of apartheid overtly. I mean, at first I thought, look, I have to tell this story. I've just played in South Africa. And then I thought, I can't actually bring myself to be the representative of the South African oppressed and tell their story. I'm not entitled to do that. I don't come from there. So I'll tell the story metaphorically by being a representative of someone who's an anti-apartheid, of working on a level of high regard and respect with other musicians. But I'll tell the stories of what I know about my life, and that's the way that I can show my respect at the highest level to the musicians that I'm playing with, is that I'll try to be the best that I can. So all of that was my learning process, and it was an enormous learning process, and it changed the way I thought about music from then on. Allowed me to go in and make the Rhythm of the Saints with, you know, West African music and Brazilian drumming, and it just opened the door for me and for many other people, I guess, to be able to communicate with musicians from all over the world without having to be questioned. Everybody then thought, this is great fun and something that we all should be doing and we should be proud of. That's my big learning experience.
I think it was the bass that made you go, because I saw you last night. Question. Stop.
Thank you. My name is Tom Hay. Hello. First, I'd like to thank you very much for all your music, and Mr. Berlinger for his movie. I think there is an answer to these questions, because although the movie is beautiful, your documentary, I miss some subtext, and I think Mr. Simon was also the boy in the Band-Aid bubble, because that very year he went in February to Johannesburg. 3 months later, Band-Aid became a big thing. Live Aid in July, October, November, Sun City. And all of a sudden, South Africa, musicians who went there, were bad guys. But there were other guys. 3 months before your visit, Mr. Simon, Queen played for 2 weeks, Sun City. Rod Stewart, several concerts, even Sinatra, etc. So my question to you, Mr. Berling, is why didn't you, well, you couldn't ask Freddie Mercury, but for instance, Phil May of Queen, or Tina Turner, who played South Africa, many musicians, but they weren't blamed, it was all Mr. Simon.
I'm not sure I understand your question. Why didn't I include that in the movie? You know, a movie is many choices, and I wanted to focus on the Paul Simon South African story. You know, it just didn't seem like something to include. I mean,
brought into the picture. The second one, and it's not the metaphor of the record sleeve, and I think that is St. George in a Coptic monastery,
yes,
in Ethiopia.
Yeah, it's Coptic, that's
yes.
Right.
And it's the home country for Rastafarians, and it's the only black country that never has been colonized in Africa. Was that by purpose? Was that also a message by you?
It wasn't. It's one of the many aspects of this that seem to make sense in retrospect, and maybe made sense on some deeper cosmic level that I was unaware of. As soon as I saw that image, I wanted that image to be the image, but really I didn't think about it on that deeper level.
Any other questions from the hall?
Yeah.
Yeah? Second man. If you were to make a second Graceland, where would that be?
I have been doing nothing but making second Graceland.
That was almost my question.
Any other questions? Yeah, sorry. There's Zydekin on the album.
Yes.
Yeah.
We had 9 or 10 songs
in which
from South Africa. And I then came back and I wanted to continue the theme, and I chose to go with the accordion. So I went to Louisiana, which is Cajun country, and accordion, and that's when the Zydeco track was made. Those tracks were made after South Africa.
Nog 2 of 3 vragen. Ja, ja, sta dan op. Oké. So. Question? He's 26, his mother played the music while he was in the womb. He danced from his early childhood, but has no question, just saying that it was fantastic. What's the question? What did Mandela think about Graceland?
You know, Hugh grew up with the Mandela family. Hugh knows Mr. Mandela. Was there ever a discussion? We never discussed it. The only thing that I talked to him about when I met him was the fact that Joseph Shabalala's brother had been murdered, and what could be done about bringing the murderer to justice. That's really all we talked about that night. But did you ever discuss Graceland with Nelson?
I never discussed Graceland with him, but he said, "Here, I would very much like to meet this Paul Simon." Do you think he'll be coming to this country? he had a reception, especially for Paul, which really put off a lot of the people who were the leadership of the boycotts wherever we were, because when Paul came into the reception, the people who had been at the front line of the boycotts were the ones who were escorting him to the podium. Nelson Mandela.
That's called revenge.
But the greatest memory I have Graceland is the Minister of Culture in Zimbabwe, just before we went to do that video there, he came to me and he said, "Hugh, this is a friend of yours, Simon Epoli. Why does he have two first names?"
Everyone's favorite song. Okay, can do that.
Songs have their own lives. They outlive even the writer most of the time. I don't have a favorite song. I love the whole album.
Joe?
Same album. I love that album. And the Christmas too. Yeah, both.
What's your favorite album?
I love it.
Yeah. Oh, there's one song that you wake up to, no? Okay. I like that song. Surely you guys have a favorite song.
Yeah, Sounds of Silence.
Great.
My favorite song.
Big one.
I'm African States.
Okay.
And Homeless. Because I grew up living in a suitcase. That is, if you know, being a musician, you're always touring, you're not in one place, so your life is based on a suitcase. Next town, next move. But Homeless and the African Sky is one of my favorites. The album is Saint Magnifique.
I'll tell you this. I'll tell you what I think is the most interesting of, and maybe it is my favorite song, and that's Graceland. And here's why. The first sessions that I did were with Forere when we did The Boy in the Bubble, and we did another track, and when it was at the end of the day, I said, you know, I don't like that track, but I do like the drums. I just like to keep the drums, and I just kept the drums. And when I met Ray, I said, "Ray, listen, what would you play to these kind of drums, this beat?" Because to me it sounded something like rockabilly, which is, you know, a music that I grew up with and loved. And Ray said, it sounds something like country, American country. And he started to play like that beginning, the way he plays the rhythm. And he was playing it like his memory of American country. And then he played, it's in the key of E, and then he played this C sharp minor chord, which you seldom heard minor chords in South African music. They're all major chords. And I said to Ray, I love that you did that. Why did you play that? And he said, "That's a chord that you use all the time in your music." So, and then when I started to write the song and kept singing, "I'm going to Graceland, Graceland," I kept thinking, well, I have to change these words, because obviously, I can't, this is not about Elvis Presley, I'll have to change the words. And then after a couple of months, I finally said, I'm not going to change the words, I better go to Graceland and find out why. But what's so interesting about this is that Ray gives his impression of country music from what he remembers from his childhood. I take the way he plays over this drum track that was originally to another groove. He takes a chord change that he knows from my music. I hear the whole thing as something like rockabilly, and subconsciously sing about Graceland and end up going down there and writing the song. I mean, this is really world music happening. This is our memories from what we heard, and we've heard this music from around the world, all of us, for our whole lives we've heard it. And somewhere in there it comes back, and I think part of why people responded so immediately to the whole album of Graceland is they heard something that they knew, and at the same time, they heard something that they'd never heard before, and the thrill of the combination was what made for such a joyful experience for all of us.
Jill, it's your turn. Your favorite song.
Well, I was going to say Graceland, because my favorite moment in the movie is when Paul dissects that song, because for me, you know, when I first heard that song and that album, it was just very mysterious. And when Paul talks about it and just gave that incredibly eloquent explanation, living that moment in the film, in the editing room, really just has given that song so much more meaning for me.
One more question, yes? Question is, do they want to sing, does Paul want to sing an a cappella song? He said, end this show. We're not going to end. Can we sing?
I have to demur from that, because I've just been singing for like 3 nights in a row, and I don't know if you can hear it, but I can hear it, that my voice is trying.
Okay, we're not going to sing.
Who said that?
Who said that?
I'm sorry, we're going to ask Barney to sing the last song.
All right. Cool. Okay, we're stopping. Thank you very much. Gentlemen, Paul Schreiber!